An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine by John Henry Newman. Introduction, Part 3. Thus much on the doctrine of the Holy Trinity. Let us proceed to another example. There are two doctrines which are generally associated with the name of a father of the 4th and 5th centuries, and which can show little definite, or at least but partial, testimony in their behalf before his time: purgatory and original sin. The dictum of Vincent admits both or excludes both, according as it is or is not rigidly taken. But if used by Aristotle's Lesbian rule, then, as Anglicans would wish, it can be made to admit original sin and exclude purgatory. On the one hand, some notion of suffering or disadvantage or punishment after this life, in the case of the faithful departed, or other vague forms of the doctrine of purgatory, has in its favor almost a consensus of the four first ages of the Church, though some fathers state it with far greater openness and decision than others. It is, as far as words go, the confession of St. Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, St. Perpetua, St. Cyprian, Origen, Lactantius, St. Hilary, St. Cyril of Jerusalem, St. Ambrose, St. Basil, St. Gregory of Nazianzus and of Nyssa, St. Chrysostom, St. Jerome, St. Paulinus, and St. Augustine. And so, on the other hand, there is a certain agreement of fathers from the first that mankind has derived some disadvantage from the sin of Adam. Next, when we consider the two doctrines more distinctly, the doctrine that between death and judgment there is a time or state of punishment, and the doctrine that all men, naturally propagated from fallen Adam, are in consequence born destitute of original righteousness, we find on the one hand several, such as Tertullian, St. Perpetua, St. Cyril, St. Hilary, St. Jerome, St. Gregory Nyssen, as far as their words go, definitely declaring a doctrine of purgatory, whereas no one will say that there is a testimony of the fathers equally strong for the doctrine of original sin, though it is difficult here to make any definite statement about their teaching without going into a discussion on the subject. On the subject of purgatory, there were, to speak generally, two schools of opinion. The Greek, which contemplated a trial of fire at the last day through which all were to pass, and the African, resembling more nearly the present doctrine of the Roman Church. And so there were two principal views of original sin, the Greek and the African or Latin. Of the Greek, the judgment of Hooker is well known, though it must not be taken in the letter. "The heresy of free will was a millstone about those Pelagians' neck. Shall we therefore give sentence of death inevitable against all those fathers in the Greek Church, which, being mispersuaded, died in the error of free will?" Bishop Taylor, arguing for an opposite doctrine, bears a like testimony. "Original sin," he says, "as it is at this day commonly explicated, was not the doctrine of the primitive Church. But when Pelagius had puddled the stream, St. Austin was so angry that he stamped and disturbed it more. And truly, I do not think that the gentleman that urged against me St. Austin's opinion do well consider that I profess myself to follow those fathers who were before him, and whom St. Austin did forsake, as I do him, in the question." The same is asserted or allowed by Jansenius, Petavius, and Walch, men of such different schools that we may surely take their agreement as a proof of the fact. A late writer, after going through the testimonies of the fathers one by one, comes to the conclusion first that the Greek Church in no point favored Augustine, except in teaching that from Adam's sin came death, and, after the time of Methodius, an extraordinary and unnatural sensuality also. Next, that the Latin Church affirmed, in addition, that a corrupt and contaminated soul, and that by generation, was carried on to his posterity. And lastly, that neither Greeks nor Latins held the doctrine of imputation. It may be observed, in addition, that in spite of the forcible teaching of St. Paul on the subject, the doctrine of original sin appears neither in the Apostles' or the Nicene Creed. One additional specimen shall be given as a sample of many others. I betake myself to one of our altars to receive the Blessed Eucharist. I have no doubt whatever on my mind about the gift which that sacrament contains. I confess to myself my belief, and I go through the steps on which it is assured to me. The presence of Christ is here, for it follows upon consecration, and consecration is the prerogative of priests, and priests are made by ordination, and ordination comes in direct line from the apostles. Whatever be our other misfortunes, every link in our chain is safe. We have the apostolic succession. We have a right form of consecration. Therefore, we are blessed with the great gift. Here the question rises in me. Who told you about that gift? I answer, I have learned it from the fathers. I believe the real presence because they bear witness to it. St. Ignatius calls it the medicine of immortality. St. Irenaeus says that our flesh becomes incorrupt and partakes of life and has the hope of the resurrection, as being nourished from the Lord's body and blood, that the Eucharist is made up of two things, an earthly and an heavenly. Perhaps Origen and perhaps Magnus after him say that it is not a type of our Lord's body, but his body. And St. Cyprian uses language as fearful as can be spoken of those who profane it. I cast my lot with them. I believe as they. Thus I reply, and then the thought comes on me a second time. And do not the same ancient fathers bear witness to another doctrine which you disown? Are you not as a hypocrite, listening to them when you will, and deaf when you will not? How are you casting your lot with the saints, when you go but halfway with them? For of whether of the two do they speak the more frequently, of the real presence in the Eucharist, or of the Pope's supremacy? You accept the lesser evidence and reject the greater. In truth, scanty as the anti-Nicene notices may be of the papal supremacy, they are both more numerous and more definite than the adducible testimonies in favor of the real presence. The testimonies to the latter are confined to a few passages such as those just quoted. On the other hand, of a passage in St. Justin, Bishop Kay remarks, Lenori infers that Justin maintained the doctrine of transubstantiation. It might, in my opinion, be more plausibly urged in favor of consubstantiation, since Justin calls the consecrated elements bread and wine, though not common bread and wine. We may therefore conclude that when he calls them the body and blood of Christ, he speaks figuratively. Clement, observes the same author, says that the scripture calls wine a mystical symbol of the holy blood. Clement gives various interpretations of Christ's expressions in John 6 respecting his flesh and blood, but in no instance does he interpret them literally. His notion seems to have been that, by partaking of the bread and wine in the Eucharist, the soul of the believer is united to the spirit, and that by this union the principle of immortality is imparted to the flesh. It has been suggested by some, says Waterland, that Tertullian understood John chapter 6 merely of faith, or doctrine, or spiritual actions, and it is strenuously denied by others. After quoting the passage, he adds, "All that one can justly gather from this confused passage is that Tertullian interpreted the bread of life in John 6 of the Word, which he sometimes makes to be vocal and sometimes substantial, blending the ideas in a very perplexed manner, so that he is no clear authority for construing John 6 of doctrines, etc. All that is certain is that he supposes the Word made flesh, the Word incarnate, to be the heavenly bread spoken of in that chapter. Origen's general observation relating to that chapter is that it must not be literally but figuratively understood." Again, "It is plain enough that Eusebius followed Origen in this matter, and that both of them favored the same mystical or allegorical construction. Whether constantly and uniformly, I need not say." I will but add the incidental testimony afforded on a late occasion. How far the Anglican doctrine of the Eucharist depends on the times before the Nicene Council, how far on the times after it, may be gathered from the circumstance that when a memorable sermon was published on the subject, out of about 140 passages from the Fathers appended in the notes, not in formal proof, but in general illustration, only 15 were taken from anti-Nicene writers. With such evidence, the anti-Nicene testimonies which may be cited in behalf of the authority of the Holy See need not fear a comparison. Faint they may be one by one, but at least we may count 17 of them, and they are various, and are drawn from many times and countries, and thereby serve to illustrate each other and form a body of proof. Whatever objections may be made to this or that particular fact, and I do not think any valid ones can be raised, still, on the whole, I consider that a cumulative argument rises from them in favor of the ecumenical and the doctrinal authority of Rome, stronger than any argument which can be drawn from the same period for the doctrine of the real presence. I shall have occasion to enumerate them in the fourth chapter of this essay. If it be said that the real presence appears, by the liturgies of the fourth or fifth century, to have been the doctrine of the earlier, since those very forms probably existed from the first in divine worship, this is doubtless an important truth. But then, it is true also that the writers of the fourth and fifth centuries fearlessly assert, or frankly allow, that the prerogatives of Rome were derived from apostolic times, and that because it was the See of St. Peter. Moreover, if the resistance of St. Cyprian and Firmilian to the Church of Rome, in the question of baptism by heretics, be urged as an argument against her primitive authority, or the earlier resistance of Polycrates of Ephesus, let it be considered first whether all authority does not necessarily lead to resistance. Next, whether St. Cyprian's own doctrine, which is in favor of Rome, is not more weighty than his act, which is against her. Thirdly, whether he was not already in error in the main question under discussion, and Firmilian also. And lastly, which is the chief point here, whether in like manner we may not object, on the other hand, against the real presence, the words of Tertullian, who explains, "This is my body," by "a figure of my body," and of Origen, who speaks of "our drinking Christ's blood not only in the rite of the sacraments, but also when we receive his discourses, and says that that bread which God the Word acknowledges as his body is the word which nourishes souls. Passages which admit of a Catholic interpretation, when the Catholic doctrine is once proved, but which, prima facie, run counter to that doctrine. It does not seem possible, then, to avoid the conclusion that whatever be the proper key for harmonizing the records and documents of the early and later Church, and true as the dictum of Vincentius might be considered in the abstract, and possible as its application might be in his own age, when he might almost ask the primitive centuries for their testimony, it is hardly available now, or effective of any satisfactory result. The solution it offers is as difficult as the original problem. End of Part 3 of the Introduction to An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine.